Welcome to the HCD Podcast Mindset, your go-to destination for exploring the fascinating realms of behavioral science, neuromarketing, and consumer research. I'm your host, Michelle Nagella, and I'm excited to lead you through today's engaging conversation, brimming with insights to ignite your curiosity and enrich your understanding. In today's episode, we are privileged to welcome Alex Wu, the visionary founder and CEO of W2O, a flavor technology firm revolutionizing the food industry for the past 15 years. With a deep understanding of contemporary taste and smell neuroscience, Alex specializes in crafting better food using cutting-edge, clean-label, plant-based ingredients. His expertise is sought after by food and beverage companies worldwide as he leads efforts in new product development, including salt and sugar reduction and enhancing multisensory eating experiences. Now, before we dive into our conversation with Alex, a quick reminder to like and subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on all our thought-provoking episodes. And don't forget to explore our website, www.hcdi.net, for additional resources such as white papers and conference presentations. Now, whether you're commuting, working out, or simply unwinding, let's embark on another curious conversation right here on HCD's Mindset. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Mindset. Today, I'm super excited to have a good friend of mine, Alex Wu, join us. So, Alex, if you could go ahead and introduce yourself real quick. Who are you and what is it that you do?
Hi, everyone. This is Alex Wu. I'm a food scientist by training. 10, 15 years ago, I discovered taste and smell neuroscience. So I've been busy applying contemporary taste and smell neuroscience in developing better foods with plant-based ingredients. So basically, I'm a flavor technology specialist.
You know, that's really interesting. I don't think I ever really asked you this. You said, you know, about 15 years ago, you kind of fell into neuroscience. What drew you to neuroscience?
Yeah, it's, traditionally food science is based on chemistry and engineering and microbiology. But I always feel something is missing. Mm. So for 100 years, we focus on making food. And I believe the missing 50% is all reaction to the food in front of me.
Yeah.
During eating and drinking. That's called flavor, which is a cross-modal integration of five senses.
Yeah, so there's a lot kind of going in there, and you just kind of wanted to understand what that is.
Yeah. So I believe the more you can apply technology from other industry like neuroscience, the more powerful food science will be. You'll be able to make foods that's better not only for us, but also for the planet.
That's a good way to kind of get into what is exactly a food scientist? What is it that you do?
Yeah, food science is the study of processed food. So it's based on basic principles in microbiology, chemistry, engineering. So you basically learn the science and technology behind making food that is processed from agricultural raw material like fruits and vegetables and meat into food that tastes good and cheap for the masses and will last for like a year.
No,
so example would be fruit become fruit juice, sugar become candies, cocoa become chocolate, and meat become jerky, for example. Those are the topic that we learned, milk into cheese. Terms of the science and technology needed.
So it's like transforming those ingredients into something else, something that is more mass consumable.
Convert things from perishable to shelf stable using science and technology.
Now, is that something you always wanted to do?
Oh, no. I kind of accidentally run into it. I think I was good in chemistry, but the selection of food science as a topic 30 years ago was sort of accidental.
What do you mean? What happened?
Well, this is maybe personal, but oversharing or not, I was like aimless in undergraduate. It was I had a plant pathology major, which I was not so interested in. So I have a few close friends. They said, "Let's go to the United States." I was in Taiwan, and let's study. And then I say, "Study what?" And then my friend said, who passed away already, he said, "I heard food science is a good topic because there's lots of jobs." So that's
Oh.
how I run into it. I picked food science, and I'm so happy I did.
Wow, so that is very serendipitous. Where did you go?
I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, that's quite different than Taiwan.
Yeah, it's like shocking. But yeah, I went there and studied food science, and I got a master's degree, and later on I got a PhD degree. Master was in natural color, and PhD was in natural flavor.
Wow, that's great. So that's worked out quite well. Now, if you could speak a bit about your journey into this world of food science. I know you focused a lot on sweeteners. How did you end up kind of going towards sweeteners?
Yeah, I work for what I call big food nowadays, like Pepsi, Kraft, and Wrigley for 20 some years. And 15 years ago, I started my own company, and I was following the advice as a few of the basic advice for setting up a technology consulting company. One of them is finding a niche. So I specialize in flavor, and within that, it becomes sweeteners and natural flavor modifiers and bitterness blocker and multi-sensory experience become a couple of my practice areas. And those are really the hot topics in the past 15 years. So I pick a niche, but I kind of follow my client in terms of what subject want to study underneath that taste and smell, which is a niche, but it's still pretty broad.
It's really interesting. The general public themselves don't really realize the amount of work that goes into producing the food that they eat all the time. And the example I like to give people all the time is, you like orange juice, right? And they'll usually say yes. And I say, well, when you buy your orange juice in January versus August, or March versus October, you expect it to taste the same, right? And then we say, well, yes, of course. And I'm like, but it shouldn't, right? And so that's a lot of that taste modulation. Whether there's a hurricane that comes through a certain part of the world, or if it happens to be that the fruit is out of season, people expect their food to taste exactly the same, no matter what happened, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. But on the other hand, nowadays, knowing some of the things that may be overdone in terms of making food too craveable and too attractive, and then we tend to overeat in this country, and then obesity is a problem. So nowadays, I actually believe, don't go too crazy on highly processed food to make the food so the same and perfectly sweet and perfectly yellow like orange juice. We want to focus on how do you make an acceptable food that is still can be cheap enough, but minimally processed. Try not to process so much. Try to have an ingredient statement like five or less. And try to use simple and real food. And this is the direction I believe that the kind of the small food of the United States, part of the food industry, are working, whereas big food are also searching for solution to crack the code.
Is that like a thing you see happening more, like the rise of small food?
Yeah. It's still a very small percentage of the market share for the whole food industry, but I believe some of the principle they're demonstrating and the best practices they have is the future of food.
Yeah. Now, something you said there is really interesting. You were talking about acceptability, really, right? So, how can you make something acceptable to the consumer? And that seems like a loaded word in a way, because it can mean a lot of things. So, what do you think acceptability means for the basic consumer?
Yeah, I think I'm like more like a taste and smell guy. This is probably I it's my opinions, but I think about acceptability as both wanting and liking. Liking and wanting, as you are the expert in this field, are two different things, but they go together. So the acceptability has to be for both of those factor to be complete, at least those two factors.
So then what do you do as more of like a food scientist's perspective when you come in to do your work, do your research, do your creation? How do you navigate that balance between creating products that are enjoyable and satisfying for the consumers on what they want and like, but also considering the health impacts? Because that sounds like it's also something that's really important to you.
Yeah, it make food that's not only better for a human but better for the planet.
Yeah.
That comes to utilizing some new emerging technology that will enable you to do that. So one of them is neuroscience. So neuroscience is like understanding why sugar is sweet and why table salt is salty. And if you know how it works and why it works, and you can come up with other ways to make things sweet without sugar, and that's called sugar reduction, and also to make things saltier without table salt by making it more umami and kakumi. So those are the kind of the better for your food coming from new technology like neuroscience. There are others, like precision fermentation is another one.
So tell me a little bit about these advances. So you say precision fermentation. Tell me a little bit, can you discuss like some of the recent advancements in this space or the trends in sweeteners or in flavor modulators? Something that you think is particularly exciting or promising.
Yeah, I consider precision fermentation as one of the top three
What is it?
emerging. The precision fermentation.
Because there are people who are listening.
Precision fermentation is kind of a new variant of the traditional fermentation. Traditional fermentation is how we make bread and beer. We ferment with yeast, traditional native yeast, found in nature, and we make a new food. Whereas precision fermentation become a new emerging technology in the past 10 years, it's about using GMO yeast. So these yeast are reprogrammed to not make new food in general, but more specifically make a new food ingredients. So in high yield and high efficiency. And require nearly no water, and it's done in a fermentation tank, not in farming. So it's a way of making high-value, very high-value-added food ingredient cheaper, faster,
More
and
sustainable,
more
it sounds.
sustainable. Yeah, more sustainable. So less carbon footprint, less water requirement, high efficiency. So no volume limitation and that kind of thing. So you start typically with some kind of a sugar source, like sugar cane or corn syrup. You end up with these high value ingredients. So one example, there are sweetener, flavor, and others. So sweetener, one very famous example is Ribollosi M, as in Mary. That's the best tasting stevia sweeteners in the leaf. There's 60 of them. This is the best tasting one, but there's so little in the leaves. It's really almost impossible at low cost. So it's possible at high cost, but there are alternative way of making it. Precision fermentation is one way by a couple of leaders in the field, and they can make 95% typically or higher purity of this powder that is Ribollosi M, almost 100% pure.
Oh, wow.
And that are cheaper, more available, more sustainable than the traditional farm-based stevia leaf extract. So that will be one example. There are other flavor examples and color example and protein example too.
That's really interesting. And, you've said some words there that I think can be triggering to people, right? So some people react very poorly when they hear things like GMO. So we often see debates around the safety or efficacy of any of these sort of manipulations that we make, thinking artificial sweeteners in particular, but other types of sweeteners that people can be concerned about. How do you address concerns and maybe even more especially the misconceptions in this type of work?
Yeah, we should separate these things. So artificial versus natural is one topic. Definitely there's a migration from artificially made sweetener like aspartame, sucralose ASK, towards quote unquote natural. There's no legal definition in the US, but natural can be quote unquote can be think about as plant-based or found in nature. So there's a migration from the artificially made to the natural one, like stevia, leaf extract, like monk fruit extract. So that's one. So that's better. I'm for that. I'm for migration towards plant-based sweetener because they are found in nature, consumed by people in a certain part of the world, mainly Asia, for hundreds of years without any safety concern. So GMO is different. GMO is it come started in Europe when but US followed in the past 20 years. It is important to know whether things are made with GMO or not. But they are so I'm sort of torn on this, but I think in general, I will say I'm more pro GMO rather than against GMO because it's a trade-off. Now, the GMO, if the GMO is making new food, I'm more wary about it. Say making a fish that's never been found in nature,
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
but if it's making a nature identical or found in nature molecule, like in this case, people are making Reb M successfully. It's found in nature. It's just rare. So to make it more available, I am for using GMO. And the GMO, as a minimum, you need to demonstrate there is no GMO DNA or protein whatsoever in the final product that you are making. And because it's also more sustainable, I think it's a way to kind of save our earth. So I am in on balance, I will say I'm pro GMO,
Or even,
not.
sustain life because, we're lucky to live in a situation where we have a lot of access to food, but not everybody does, and so being able to develop rice, for example, that has more nutrient in it or is more hardy for growth is certainly beneficial.
Yeah, as long as the nutrient that we're making as part of the rice is found in nature. I'm not in the medical field, but I do sugar reduction weight management, so I touch upon insulin. I believe all the insulin today as a drug is all made by GMO,
I think so too.
precision fermentation. So that technology has been used in medicine before food. I need to check that out though. So maybe you want to edit this part out of
Yeah, we
somewhere.
can always go back and check or
Yeah,
add it
I don't have an image of a
down.
paper I read, but that just I mean the other thing is I have read recently there's a generational change in
Okay.
terms of GMO acceptance from boomers who are more against it towards millennials and Zs. They are more open
Oh,
to
really?
trade off as long as there is a benefit
Yeah.
that is better for the planet and better for human life. I read and it kind of makes sense to me. The younger generation are more open to new technology. But I don't know whether that's been collaborated and supported by basically original research or just people self-reporting.
That's interesting because a lot of talk at the more recent sensory conferences and food science conferences has been around plant-based, right? So you go to these meetings and it's just constantly papers and posters and presentations on plant-based foods and acceptability. And there seems to be a real problem in maybe Western cultures on acceptability of like plant-based burgers, for example. But from what I'm hearing from you, it sounds like there might be generational differences on understanding those trade-offs, because I think a lot of like the targeting they've tried to do in the US has been the benefits, right, of plant-based meats on the environment. Not so much the health, right? Because like the Impossible Burger or the Impossible Whopper, right, is not healthier for people. But the idea is more that it is more sustainable or more eco-friendly, right?
Yeah, it's an animal free plant-based in the case of the example that you use, it's really they find a way to make meat flavors
Yeah.
using plant heme based compound, which is responsible for the meaty and bloody flavors. And but it's really about saving the earth and primary, not saving human.
Yeah.
It's not harmful for human, but it's really the I think Impossible Foods is mission is really about making the world a better place.
Right. And so how do you feel about a lot of these plant-based foods moving forward? Like, what do you think the accept is, or do you think that the Western diet is going to be more accepting of this, or?
I think so. I think so. It will be a viable, important option as we move into the next decades to come. We will not have enough meat to go around.
Right.
And so a option is definitely a non-animal option is definitely in play. I mean, plant-based right now is suffering some headwinds, both technologically and also commercially, but I don't think it's gonna go away. It will have to regroup. Two things, you know, is one is like taste, the other one is cost.
Yeah.
So on the taste, my thinking is actually maybe you don't want to match the original animal
Yeah.
flavors, such as in non-milk, dairy milk, or no cow cheese without cow.
Right.
And maybe the focus could be make it equally acceptable a product that doesn't match the original taste of the animal product. The other
Yeah, because
one
I
is
think the
cost.
push to make it the same pretty much leads to disappointment, right? Because if it's not the same at all in any tiny variation, then people automatically will say it's not as good, right?
Yeah, it's tricky to do to match the animal flavor. It's harder to then creating a plant-based equally like wanted
Yeah. So it really
like
needs to be its own thing.
yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that as well. Kind of getting back to like taste modulation, and this kind of relates to this because as the people creating these products are manipulating different pieces of the puzzle, right? All of my years at Monell and now working more on the consumer research side, Something that really comes up is that difference between the basic research that's happening at places like Monell and the actual application of this research to make real products is taste preferences. So we know that taste preferences can vary hugely, greatly among individuals. So how do you, in your work, account for this variability? Like, what implications does individual genetics and taste preferences, what does that have on food product development? You know, especially when you're talking about making mass-produced foods, you can't really cater to, you know, taste genetics, right?
Yeah, you have to take an average, starting by never do taste tests with one person, which is very commonly done in startup.
Oh, really? Oh, just like the
Yeah,
brand
because
manager?
no, this I'm t more like talking about the startup where it's a strong man or strong woman company, and I decide it tastes good to me, go. It doesn't taste go back. So, to accommodate for the great variability in basic taste using sweetness or bitterness as an example, you have to do at least 6 to 10 people taste tests using a format called
Yeah.
flash profiling, which
Just to
is
cover those
one.
people. Yeah.
Yeah, it's randomly selected, not trained. So in a typical food company, we roughly has more female than female in R&D and in marketing, roughly.
Yeah.
So if you take a random sample, you got 60-40, which is close enough to the population of 51-49 in terms of gender divide, I understood. And then untrained, and then the samples are randomized, random number, random order, same temperature, same size, same cups. And so you have a chance of getting one third people as non-tasters, or I should say more accurately, less sensitive taster,
Right.
average taster, more sensitive taster in terms of bitterness and sweetness. And it's gender sort of balanced. It's phenotype sort of balance, variability. So you try to do it at a certain set time, like late morning, mid afternoon. So you take out the satiety factor, hopefully, that kind of thing. So it start with doing the right kind of taste test, so that you guide R&D from discovery to commercialization rather than misguided with one person tasting.
So what does a food scientist do when they see the research come out about crop tasters, right? Or you know, the latest taste genetics work. You know, what does someone that's in the business, that say, you know, a food scientist at a large food manufacturer, what are they supposed to do with that information?
Yeah, so this is I think there are very few of us in the food industry that try to apply really intensively as a mission, translating neuroscience into food science. So because it's not thought of yet as a main foundation for food science, but it's coming. It's just like they don't teach product development 30 years ago in food science. Now they do. They only teach chemistry and microbiology. And so this in embedding neuroscience in food science is coming. It's being done in the past 5 years. It's just not enough. For example, is maybe less than 10 professors in food science. They are really neuroscientists. They're practicing their science and technology in food science. So I won't name them if you don't want me to, but Ohio State has
Go ahead.
one or two professors. You can edit this out if you
No,
think.
it's totally
I'm
fine.
not promote. I'm
Yeah.
I all of them actually. I'm not endorsing Chris
Yeah.
Simons and Devin Peterson,
Right.
Dando in Cornell,
Yep.
Lim in Oregon State, Seal in Arkansas, I think.
Yeah.
There's a there are more. So there are, and then of course the whole Monell,
Yeah.
all about taste and smell. And taste and smell, they're a medical aspect, but they're, you know, I look at it through the lens of food.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
those are the leading neuro food scientists, I call them,
Yeah.
that are typical food scientists doing product development, trying to make food better, should pay attention to it. It's kind of painful because just like I went through this journey 10, 15 years ago. I think the first time I went to Monell,
Yeah.
not Monell, to ACAM. Maybe I saw you there. This
Yeah,
is 15
probably.
years, 15, 10 years. I go every year. I actually understand only 1% of what everybody is saying. So I just even that 1%, I started to realize, oh, it's T1R2, T1R3, the only receptor we have. That's why sugar is sweet, the Venus flytrap. Then I say, oh,